would be sweeter than my sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading from Hayti Police, Memoirs of a Former Durham Police Officer, by Marshall Thompson, written in 1997. Marshall Thompson was born and raised in Durham, North Carolina, just as his parents and grandparents before him. He graduated from Hillside High School in 1963, Durham Technical Institute in 1971, and North Carolina Central University in 1977. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps for 4 years and on the Durham Police Department for 19 years and 2 months. He also was a member of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity and Doric Lodge No. 28 of Free and Accepted Masons. He's also a member of St. Joseph AME Church in Durham, North Carolina. If not you, who? If not now, when? Reverend Jesse Jackson. Chapter 1. It was Friday, February 13, 1973. I, Officer M. Thompson, and Officer George Green were on patrol in the western part of downtown Durham. I had been a police officer in Durham for about 4.5 years. Officer Green had been an officer for a little over a month. We got along quite well. We both were wounded Vietnam veterans, and about the same age. I was born in February of 45, and George in January of 45. While I was reared in the city of Durham, and graduated from the all-black Hillside High School class of 1963, George had graduated from a county school, Merrick Moore, class of 63. The 3-to-11 shift that we were working was rather quiet and uneventful until a call came to Officer Tony Freeman a little after 7 p.m. Officer Freeman was a white officer who later went to the EMS and fire department of the city of Durham. The dispatcher gave a man-shot call to Freeman. He stated the location as Tops Service Station at Broad Street and Guess Road. The dispatcher told me, M. Thompson, and Officer Green to assist. With my 4.5 years, I was the most veteran officer headed toward the scene of the shooting. When Green and I arrived on the scene at the service station, I witnessed an ambulance already there. The attendants were already loading a black man into the ambulance. The most shocking thing that I observed was Officer J. E. Hunter standing in front of Officer Freeman. Hunter was on the vice squad and was in civilian clothes. He was a big man, about 6'4", 270 pounds. A Korean War veteran with 19 years on the force, Hunter had helped train me when he was a uniformed patrol officer. I said, "Green, I'm glad Hunter is here, because one needs experience at a shooting." The area we were in was an area that is still a dividing line between a predominantly black area, Wall Town, and the more prevailing white area to the immediate west. Then, to my surprise, I saw Officer Hunter's arms go into the air as the one being searched. I thought, doesn't Officer Freeman know who Officer Hunter is? I was driving the patrol car when first entering the service station lot. A large crowd of mostly white citizens were beginning to gather. I got out of the car immediately when I observed Officer Hunter being searched by Officer Freeman. I asked Freeman, "Do you know who this man is?" He replied, "Yes, it's Officer Hunter." I asked, "Did he shoot anyone?" Freeman hesitated to answer. Then Hunter replied in a loud voice, "I popped him. I popped him." I told Freeman, "Freeman, I will take this case if it's all right with you." Freeman said, "You got it." Officer Freeman then gave me the snub-nosed .38 caliber pistol that belonged to Officer Hunter. The pistol had been fired. I immediately escorted Officer Hunter to the back seat of the patrol car. Cages had recently been placed between the front and back seat of our police cruisers. Officer Green took a seat on the driver's side. I sat beside Hunter in the back. Before leaving the scene, Officers Green, Freeman, and I gathered what information we could from witnesses at the scene concerning the shooting. Now I find out it's a DOA, or Dead on Arrival, at Duke Emergency. This information came over the police radio. Hunter was not saying very much at this time. A few of the white citizens knew Officer Hunter and came to the back window to ask him how he was doing. He didn't respond. I asked Green to drive to police headquarters, which was at the corner of Mangum and Chapel Hill Streets in 1973. We had a little ways to go from the Northgate Shopping Center area to headquarters, about 4 miles. I thought this would be the opportunity to learn from Officer Hunter what actually happened. Hunter continued to say, "I popped him, Marshal." He called me by my first name. That made me feel better. I said, "John, a lot of people at headquarters will ask you a lot of things. Here's your opportunity to tell me first, and in whatever confidence that I can provide. What happened?" Before John answered my question, my mind reverted back to 1968, when Officer Hunter was my training officer and I was a young rookie. We were patrolling one day when John began to relate some of his experiences on the force to me. John said, "Marshal, you never know what will happen on this job. I had to arrest the officer that trained me, Walter Barnes. You don't know, one day you may have to arrest me." Those words were burning in my ears as we continued south on Gregson Street into the downtown area of Durham. John began to talk again. He said, "The SOB tried to get away, but I popped him." Amos, the man who had been killed, was a lifelong friend of Officer Hunter's. Amos Wilson's brother was the driver of the car that John and Amos were riding in when they entered the parking lot of Topps Service Station to obtain some fuel. While the brother was getting gas, Amos excused himself to use the bathroom. He never made it. John shot him, point blank, in his heart. I found out that information later. John didn't tell me what happened during the ride to police headquarters. Amos's brother told me at a later time. When we, that's J.E. Hunter, suspect and Officer Green, and me, M. Thompson, arrived at police headquarters, I noticed that the big brass were already beginning to gather. Lieutenant Pendergrass ordered me to take Hunter to a room that's located behind the desk sergeant's desk until Detective L. Leathers called for us. At first thought, the investigating detective wanted to talk to me. I talked to Detective Leathers on the other side of police headquarters at the Detective Bureau. Officer Green stayed with Officer Hunter. I told Detective Leathers what little I knew. He then asked me to bring Hunter to him. Detective Lorenzo Leathers was another black policeman who'd come on the force during the mid-50s. Lowe, as he was called, had been a paratrooper during World War II and had stayed in the States. He, like John Hunter, had gone to Hillside High School. Hunter was in the class of 48. Lowe was in the class of 42. Lowe was a dogged detective that took no favorites. He was a big man who had been a bricklayer before he became a policeman. Other officers teased him because he had a reputation for being tight with money. It's said that he paid cash for his house because he ate only nabs, that's crackers with peanut butter, and drank Pepsis to save money. The chief had to call him in once to advise him to cash his paychecks, because they hadn't been cashed in 3 months. I escorted Officer Hunter to Detective Leather's office. John had appeared intoxicated the whole time. Officer Green and I went back on patrol. We were riding in silence for a while, until George broke the silence. George said, "Mr. Thompson," he formalized my name when he wanted to talk officially. I answered, "Yes, George." He continued, "You know when I was in that room at headquarters by myself with Mr. Hunter?" "Yes, I remember." "Well," he said, "Mr. Hunter sobered up and looked me in the eye. Mr. Hunter said to me, 'Young officer, I don't know you, but as long as you stay black and a police officer, don't you do what I did tonight.'" I asked, "Were you both sitting down at the time?" "Yes," he replied. I knew John Hunter was a pacer by nature. It was hard for him to sit still. Hutter must have been very troubled by what he'd done. Fortunately, we didn't get any more police calls, because the lieutenant called us back to headquarters to transport a prisoner. That was J.E. Hutter, to the Durham County Jail. We hastened back to police headquarters to make the transport. I wanted to be the lead uniform officer on this case. John was my friend. When we arrived in the basement of police headquarters, we ran into B.E. Carrington, another young black officer who had not been on the force too long, about a year. He was brought up to date on what had happened. Ben E. Carrington was off duty, but he wanted to assist in the transport also. George, Ben, and I rode the elevator downstairs to take John from the Detective Bureau to the county jail. The Red Top, the Bastille, two names that John Hutter called the old jail. Before we left headquarters with John, I discovered that Detective Frank McCrae had been added to the case. Now, Frank was a real story. He was the first black police officer to retire from the force 2 years later in 1975. He came on the police department in 1945. He was not the first black police officer in the department. Clyde Cox and J.B. Samuels came on a year earlier, in 1944. Cox died of a heart attack in 1970. For some reason, Samuels retired a little time after McCrae. Samuels became the first black police lieutenant of the South around November 1951. Cox and McCrae became the best two detectives in Durham, and maybe even the whole Southeast from the early 50s until Cox died in 1970. McCrae was not really the same after the death of Detective Clyde Cox. Their story would take up a book all its own. During the drive to the old Red Top, I continued to sit in the back seat with John. George and Ben were up front. It then dawned on me that John had never been handcuffed. "Well," I said to myself, "I'll just keep a close eye on him." The handcuffing wasn't necessary in this case. I then remembered what John told me one day after we had placed a prisoner in jail during the time he was training me. Officer Hutter said, "Marshal, don't ever take your eyes off danger or a prisoner. There's no law that says that because you have a prisoner one minute, that same prisoner can't have your ass the next minute." A moment after leaving the police department, we were back at the door of the old county jail. It began to snow. There had not been a weather report predicting snow. If there had been, police communications would have announced it. We all got out of the police car and walked outside the back door to the elevator for the ride to the fourth floor, where the prisoners were kept. It was then that I became a little frightened, because John then became a little panicky. He began to flail his arms wildly and shouted, "Marshal, what's my bond?" John knew the layout of the jail very well. We had not gone toward the magistrate's office, so his charge of murder could be read to him and a bond set. I saw to it that we all quickly entered the elevator, where John could be better contained. He began to repeat again and again, very loudly, "What's my bond? What's my bond?" Finally, I told John, "You don't have a bond. You've been charged with murder." The elevator door opened. The jailer, Deputy Ferguson, a nice guy who'd been there for many years, was waiting on us. He, of course, knew John as well as anyone else on law enforcement in Durham. I showed the deputy the booking sheet, which Detective Leathers had filled out at police headquarters. I noticed something missing on the sheet, my name and Officer Green's. I immediately placed the names of M. Thompson, Freeman, and Green on the arrest sheet. We were the real arresting officers. John had told me several years ago that if eight officers made an arrest, those eight officers' names should be on the booking sheet. The jailer, Deputy Ferguson, took John's wallet and other valuables and placed them in a large envelope. Ferguson then said to me, "Officer Thompson, I'm going to put Officer Hutter in the federal side where he can have some peace. You know that everyone on the city and county side knows him." Officer Hutter had put most of them in jail himself at one time or another. It was a nice gesture on the deputy's part. The jail was full of prisoners that knew John Ernest Hutter. John was still saying very loudly, "What's my bond? What's my bond?" Then he said to me, "Marshal, get Ken Spaulding." Attorney Spaulding, although he had not been practicing very long, had made an excellent impression on a lot of people. He later became nationally known in 1995 to 96 as the attorney who helped in getting the Mark Furman tapes released by the North Carolina courts. I cried a little as we got back outside of the county jail. Snow had almost covered the ground. It was one of the most beautiful, whitest snows I'd ever seen. The shift was over. I parked the police car at headquarters and said goodbye to Green and Carrington. I went home to tell my wife, who was a big John Hunter fan, what had happened. I called his wife to tell her which lawyer John had asked for. I didn't explain to her everything that I knew. Green and I remained friends through the years, but we never worked together again. B.E. Carrington and I only worked together a few times after this incident. I slept very deeply that night. Friday, February the 13th, was over. But it was just one day. Chapter 2. The Durham Police Department, and especially the Afro-Americans on the Durham Police Department, were never, it seems to me, quite the same after the John Hunter incident. I'm sure that the family of Amos Wilson suffered greatly. They were devastated. John's family was, too. Black officers who worked with Officer Hunter from 1953 to 1973 were very distraught, so much so that the incident was not talked about. It was as though it had never happened. The citizens of Fayetteville Street and surrounding areas of Hayti had a love-hate relationship with John Hunter. Police work became different. Laughter left the force, it seemed, for a long time. Hunter was first and foremost a man with a lot of humor. He could make a person laugh quicker than Richard Pryor. He could also strike faster than a cobra once his patience ran thin with a recalcitrant individual. He never struck someone just to fight him, but only to bring that person under control. I asked John once, "Mr. Hunter, what's the easiest way to make an arrest?" He replied, "The easiest way you can." That could be a million ways as long as the arrestee physically submitted to lawful authority. The speculation as to why John shot Amos continues to this day. Even the court case is unclear as to what really happened and why. Be patient. I'll get back to the case as it goes to court. The men known as the Hayti Police are the focus of my attention right now. To be specific, I'll tell you about some of the Afro-Americans who came on the force from 1944 to 1969. Of course, they went through the transition, like all blacks did, from being called colored, Negro, black, and Afro-American. But, by a great many whites, they were called the Hayti Police. Hayti was a bustling black business district south of the tracks from downtown Durham. The Hayti district's demise came as a result of Progress, the Durham Expressway. There used to be 100 businesses, including movies, drugstores, a hotel, the Biltmore, restaurants, barber and beauty shops, cleaners, funeral homes, service stations, banks, insurance companies, etc. A feeble attempt has been made to bring this famous area back, but to no avail. Unlike other cities in America, Durham was different in that blacks lived in other areas all over town. Areas such as Walltown, parts of Bragtown, Pearsontown, North Durham, Hayestown, East Durham, Factory Hill, the West End, the Bottom, College Hill, Brookstown, Hickstown, or Crest Street Community, and so on. All these areas had their own black-owned businesses also. The middle of downtown was practically owned by blacks also. The Big Three, North Carolina Mutual Insurance, Mechanics and Farmers Bank, and Mutual Savings and Loan, were all on Parrish Street in the center of downtown at one time. It was appropriately called Black Wall Street. I found out the reason that we lived all over Durham was because the whites needed labor forces to live near them that were in walking distance of their homes. As years went by, living all over town came in quite handy when it was time to vote or attend previously all-white schools. All those political, social, and economic advantages that blacks enjoyed in Durham created a climate of success that was the envy of many other cities that had much larger black populations. The black officers, by and large, who came into the Durham Police Department were assigned almost exclusively to the largest black area of town, this being Hayti. Hayti was like a city unto itself. Besides the over 100 businesses on Pettigrew and Fayetteville streets, down to where Fayetteville intersected with Umstead Street, there were other very notable institutions. South of Umstead, and continuing down Fayetteville Street, there was the Stanford L. Warren Library, the Lincoln Hospital, now Lincoln Community Health Center, North Carolina Central University, the now-defunct Durham Business College, and a whole area of other businesses in the Pearsontown section below the university. I went into the Marines at age 18 after I finished high school. I didn't know any white business people until I left Durham at that time. All the business people I knew were successful black men and women. There were enough role models to last a lifetime. Among these role models were the black policemen who started coming on the force in 1944. It was not for a lack of tremendous effort on the part of the black community that these men began to arrive in the Durham Police Department at that time. Mr. Austin, the editor and owner of the Carolina Times, was in the forefront in saying that blacks should be on the force. He used his newspapers as a vehicle to help attain this goal. Blacks paid taxes, but they did not receive the benefits of these taxes. It took an incident and murder of drastic proportions to shake the white power structure out of their lethargic state. A riot occurred in Durham in 1943. It started when a black soldier who was stationed at Camp Butner, about 15 miles northeast of Durham, was shot in the back and killed by a white bus driver after an argument ensued between the two. The bus driver was eventually exonerated in court. The black soldiers who were stationed at Butner used to come to Durham to have fun, but this time they came with a vengeance and rioted. It put fear into everyone. The white police, in particular, were ill-equipped to handle professional soldiers. Panic ensued. Parts of the business district, both black and white, were destroyed. The white power structure took action. Chief King of the Durham Police had orders to interview and then hire some colored people for the department. Into this setting stepped Clyde Cox. About early 1969, in the only conversation that I enjoyed with Detective Cox, he recounted to me how his interview with Chief King transpired. The interview, according to Detective Cox, went like this. "Cox, how old are you, boy?" "I'm 30 years old, sir." "Have you ever been arrested?" "No, sir." "You mean to tell me that you're 30 years old and never been arrested?" "No, sir." "Y'all come in here," to his office workers. They came in. "I want to show y'all here a black man that's 30 years old and never been arrested." Cox stood there in the chief's office and took that abuse. He knew that he had to. He was a pioneer. Someone once said that it was easy to know who the pioneers out west were. They were the ones with the arrows in their backs. I had the honor of standing watch at Detective Cox's funeral at Mount Vernon Baptist Church on South Roxborough Street in 1970. He had served this city with more honor and dignity than most people of this time can ever imagine or appreciate. When Cox and Samuels came on the police department, July 1, 1944, they couldn't change their clothes, eat lunch, drink water, or use the bathroom at the police headquarters downtown where they, like all the officers, worked from. They had to report to work at headquarters, then cross the tracks to accomplish those things. Hayti was where they lived and worked. Lieutenant Samuels told me once that when he and Cox first came on the force, they were given a nightstick or billy club, no pistol or uniform until several weeks later, and were told to go to Pettigrew Street and clean it up. Several weeks later, they were given a pistol and a uniform. Years later, when J.B. Samuel became a lieutenant, the chief, who was at that time still Chief King, suggested to Samuel and the other black officers that they be given their own precinct in Hayti, with Samuels being in charge. Samuels refused. He knew that they would be separate and very unequal if that occurred. Samuel's Fisk University education was the most advanced degree on the entire police department for a long time. Eventually, things became better for them at headquarters downtown. Years later, in the early 1970s, the black officers became integral parts of all facets of the police department. This, too, came only after great struggle and protest. This story of protest by the 26 black officers on the Durham Police Department force of about 90 men in 1969 to 1970 was a very heroic event. This struggle could not have occurred without the black pioneers of the mid-1940s and their tremendous struggle to achieve excellence. High Point, North Carolina, has the distinction of hiring the first black officer in North Carolina in 1943. Which reminds me, after the riot in Durham in 1943, the black soldiers who were stationed at Camp Butner went back to guarding the German and Italian prisoners of war. The soldiers continued to come to Durham for rest and recreation, or to catch the train or bus for other destinations. In 1944, when the first blacks came onto the force, Durham was blessed to have many great pioneers, civic, business, and educational leaders, still alive. Persons like C.C. Spaulding of North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, Dr. James B. Shepherd, founder and president of North Carolina College for Negroes, now NCCU, Mr. Austin of the Carolina Times, attorneys and physicians galore, all the businessmen and women of the community. The black officers knew that their performance would be watched closely by all these citizens. They knew that they had to act and do their best at all times to satisfy these high achievers. And, just as importantly, they had to respect and be respected by the average person on the street who they would be dealing with most of the time. The whole white world was watching, too, including their police officer peers. If one thinks about it, things really haven't changed. The same watchdogs are still out there. Ironically enough, most of the Afro-Americans that have come on the force, from the early years to now, have been more educated and experienced than many of their white counterparts. When promotion time came and went, the blacks were told that they had to be better educated. The big lie never changes. The pressure was then, and still is, unbelievable under this cloud, no matter if black or white is in power. This is true now when some of the people in power are blacks, using the same methods to keep their peers in place in 1997. The system will hire a black to fire a black. A person has to know who he is and where he is at all times to live or survive in this system. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening. Here's what I say, nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.